Hello, I'm Richard Ady. This is Life Matters. You're on Radio National. Welcome. Today, reviving endangered languages. Some are so endangered that they require the linguistic equivalent of medical intervention. And what men think about love. Not all men, obviously, but some. I am, as I mentioned to James Carton on Radio National Breakfast, very positive about love. More on that later. If you've got a mortgage, you'll be very aware that the Reserve Bank has kept interest rates on hold again. 2 weeks ago, it could have put them up, but it didn't. And this is despite almost full employment and the resources boom in the West in particular. And part of why is that we're not happy. We're not spending. We're not hitting the shops despite them exhorting us to please, please come in for the half-year sales. We're not having it. We're not confident. Just like the people in the US and Europe, we're a bit gloomy about how things might go, but they really have good reasons to be that gloomy. Compared to them, we should be laughing, but we aren't. To try to make some sense of this and to quickly run the rule over the carbon tax, among other things, I'm joined by the two economists, David Hetherington, Executive Director of the progressive think tank Per Capita, and Oliver Hartwich, Research Fellow at the libertarian think tank, the Centre for Independent Studies. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Good morning, Richard.
David, let's do the carbon tax first and briefly. If 90% of households, or whatever the government's claim is, are going to be better off, what's the point?
The point is that it's a very, very complex proposal, and it's going to take a long time for people to absorb it. And really, the key month for the carbon tax is not July 2011, it's July 2012, when this hits people's pockets and starts to work its way through the economy and people realise that the sky is not going to fall in.
But am I right in thinking that the compensation for the tax plus the spending on encouraging alternative energy equals a sum greater than the money raised by the tax?
Yes, you are right in saying that. The key point there is that the government has linked two things together. It's linked a carbon tax in with a set of ongoing tax reform proposals that come out of the Henry Review. And that point hasn't been picked up on too much in the commentary. It's been seen as one integrated proposal, when really there's no reason why some of the proposals around raising the tax-free threshold and simplifying the income bands couldn't have been done separately. For political reasons, I suspect, the government's hitched them together, and that's why the sums add up in the way you're talking, so that so what's perceived as the cost of compensation is greater than the revenue raised by the tax.
Oliver, when you add in the implementation costs and the advertising and public information costs, you're going to love this tax, Oliver.
It looks like it, because I think this whole tax is a very complicated, very messy affair. I would probably agree that the sky is not going to fall when it's introduced, but still, it is a very difficult thing to introduce because you have to compensate so many households. And you probably overcompensate some, you undercompensate some, you have to take into account that energy expenses are very regressive, so you're probably hitting the lowest income earners hardest. And it's a very, very difficult thing to introduce, and it's probably the worst thing to introduce at a time of great economic uncertainty.
I'll come back to that, but would it have been better? I know that for political reasons they couldn't do this, but would it have been better just to have introduced an emissions trading scheme? They've said, after all, that the tax is a transitional arrangement. Is that a better way? If it's about reducing carbon emissions, is an emissions trading scheme the better way to go?
No. If you really want to reduce emissions, I would still go with a carbon tax instead of an emissions trading scheme. And I would leave it at that, and I wouldn't introduce the ETS later. I mean, we're always talking about an ETS being a market mechanism, but actually it isn't really a market, because we see what happens when you introduce an ETS. We have had it in operation in Europe for many years now, and it is extremely complicated, because under an emissions trading scheme too, you can compensate people. You introduce a big bureaucracy, and you issue free certificates, for example, to big polluters. So in the end,
to do that. You could not do that. Surely you could. You don't have to do that.
No, surely you don't have to, but that's what the Europeans do, and I'm afraid that's what the Australians are probably going to do too.
David, I saw you taking a breath, so you don't agree with Oliver.
No, I don't agree with Oliver. This really amuses me. We've been talking about this stuff for 2 or 3 years now, and Oliver's been a resolute supporter of a tax if you're going to price carbon, and I think an ETS with a floating price is the way to go. It is a market mechanism. It's a market mechanism where people can buy or sell a product, which is a carbon coupon. The key question that we're facing with here is, do we want to transition to a low carbon economy? And if so, do you believe a price is the best way to do it? Both an ETS and a tax are a form of price. Mm. And really, I think while ETS is preferable, we can cop a tax for now.
All right. I want to move on to something you said. I saw that you wrote the other day, Oliver, because you have another concern, which is related to the global problems I was alluding to earlier, that essentially this is not a good time to have a new tax in Australia because, and I don't know how many of us are across this, how worried economists of many different persuasions are about the rest of the world.
Mm. Well, I think there is never an ideal time, of course, to introduce a new tax. But
surely,
this time,
surely there's never a time to introduce a new tax for you.
But seriously, I think it is very, very difficult at the moment in the world economy because we have a number of crises almost blowing up simultaneously. We have America going towards August the 2nd, and there is still a possibility that America might default on that day. Then we have the European debt crisis that's now reached Italy, and that's an economy that's simply too big to bail out. We have Japan that's recovering from a tsunami and just passed a second emergency budget. And really, there are so many reasons to be really, really worried about the global economy. This is not the right time to add further uncertainty and really damage the one industry where Australia still has a comparative advantage.
But our wagons hitched to East Asia, to China specifically. They've been going really well.
Mm, sure, but if either of the three blow up, Japan, Europe or America, you can bet that you are going to feel it here. And you can already feel the consequences. I mean, we had a relatively sluggish share market this year. We have consumer confidence at hit rock bottom in Australia. You can see it with just shops being empty and standing idle. Mm. And you can feel that sense of uncertainty. That's why Australians are not spending, because they are just looking what happens in other places.
David?
Australia's economic fundamentals are great. They are just top shelf at the moment. Unemployment is at record lows. Mm. Interest rates are at kind of historical averages. Inflation's in the target band. The big threat to the Australian economy is confidence, which hits consumer spending. The relative impact of a carbon tax on any of this is tiny. Mm. The things that Oliver's talking about overseas have the potential to have a much greater impact. And what I find irresponsible is those people who run round in an alarmist way saying that the carbon tax is the thing that will break the back of the Australian economy.
But, okay, let's put the carbon tax to one side. These other issues that Oliver has highlighted, how much of a danger do you think they are to us? Because clearly out there in ordinary Australia land, as Oliver said, people are worried about this. There's a reticence, nothing else.
There's an unease, but a lot of that unease is brought about by the quality of the public debate and the alarmist nature of the debate around this stuff. Now, if you set aside that alarmism, what is happening overseas is really worrying. I mean, there's no question that there are now two developments occurring in parallel that either on their own or together could really throw us back into the worst days of 2008-2009, and they are the European debt crisis and the prospect that America won't lift its debt ceiling on the 2nd of August.
So the GFC, which we've been talking about for a few years, and I think most people have been thinking, well, it's, you know, we're kind of through the worst of it. It's going to get worse before it gets better?
I think on balance, that's the probability at the moment, yeah. And people don't recall that the Great Depression took 6, 7, 8 years to work through properly. And, for example, share markets didn't reclaim their 1929 levels until the early 50s. So it's not unprecedented for these things to take a very long time to play themselves out. And it looks at the moment like we're on another downhill slope. And, you know, who knows where the bottom of that is.
On Life Matters today, the two economists are in David Hetherington from Per Capita, Oliver Hartwich from the Centre for Independent Studies. I was reading, Oliver, a story in the New York Times the other day, essentially arguing that in America, consumerism, buying stuff, which has been such a driver of their economy for 30 years, possibly longer, might have had its day.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what David just talked about, that these developments take a long time to correct themselves out. They've had a party for 20 or 30 years, and, well, we don't know whether it's going to take another 20 or 30 years to correct the results of that party, but it will take a long, long time. The global financial crisis really only just erupted in 2007, so we are really in year 4 of all of this. And I think there are still too many skeletons in the closet, really, so to speak. And I think we really have to deal with the crisis. And at the moment, the Americans are not prepared to deal with it. The American economy is not growing. They still have a massive debt problem, and they're probably heading for another round of quantitative easing further down the track.
This is the economist term for printing more money.
Yes, yes. And that's what's happening. That's what's happening in America. That's what's happening in Britain. And I'm afraid there are not that many reasons to be optimistic at the moment.
But, well, I was just thinking, if consumerism turns out to have had its day, couldn't it ultimately turn into a good thing. If the end result's an economy that's built on investment and exporting.
Yeah, and savings. I mean, yes. That would be wonderful. Yes, sure. Problem is that there is a lot of historical amnesia around. People forget the bad times as soon as the good times start again. And then it takes 4 or 5 years and we're back to previous excesses. I mean, that's what happened in previous booms and bust cycles. People are incredibly forgetful about these things.
David, how if it's going to get tougher before it gets easier, how well prepared for it are we here in Australia? You were saying our fundamentals are really good. But clearly, our feeling about it is not really good.
Yeah, we're as well prepared as anybody, is the best way of putting it. We are on a path back to budget balance, which is important. Our fundamentals, as I said, are all solid. But because we are a relatively small boat in a pretty big ocean, the waves can buffet us in ways that we really can't control. So the best thing we can do is try to get our own house in order. And really to not let this kind of corrosive wave of pessimism drag us down, because that's what affects kind of, it's the animal spirits of the economy. And at the moment,
animal spirits.
They're the things that have taken a bit of a hit.
But I mean, that, I don't know, that will all be ruined, said Hanrahan quality, that we're sort of displaying. It's arguably part of our national character. It's not pessimism exactly, but it's more a kind of that'd be right. Stoicism comes out of 200 years of trying to farm some pretty hard country.
Yeah, that's a fair read, Richard. I think Australians, as you say, live in a tough country, and there is a perception that there may well be another shock around the corner. And so, what you need to do is kind of gird yourself in the good times and you know build up your defences, because you know more likely than not there's going to be another unforeseen but tough event coming around the corner, and it's quite easy to almost for that to become a self-fulfilling prophecy in the economy, because if you start talking down an economy, it develops a momentum of its own.
That makes me wonder, Oliver, about it. I suppose you have a slightly different perspective because you're still new to here. Firstly, the Americans, I think of them as full of can-do, optimism, positiveness, all this idea about failing quickly and early and how great it's been for them. Do you think that their national character might be reformed by these terrible times they're going through now?
Well, it's certainly taking a temporary hit, but I would disagree on your characterization of the Australian character.
Right.
Because the way that I have encountered it, Australians are relatively optimistic, forward-looking, she'll be right, lucky country. It's really a positive economy, or maybe it's just perspective on it that makes it appear so positive. But really,
the lucky country is a tongue-in-cheek phrase.
I know.
Not for everyone, I'm afraid.
It was intended originally as well.
But really, what I've encountered in Australia is perhaps not so much the outspoken can-do mentality, but certainly the she'll be right mate attitude, where you know that if you work hard, in the end, you'll be right.
Right. So are we being dark enough?
No, I think Australians are perhaps just realistic, really, in their assessment of the world economy now, because they are reading foreign newspapers and they see what's happening in other parts of the world, and they're just forming a very realistic assessment of it.
How much of all of this, David, is informed by the, you know, kind of the relentless battleground that has become our national polity? I mean, I think it's
almost all informed by that. I don't believe Australians spend their time reading the business and economic pages of foreign newspapers. I think Australians' messages from overseas. We do, but that's because we're policy wonks, you know, to our eternal cost. But most people get their news from that kind of debate within the national polity, as you say, and it has a very fraught kind of alarmist tone at the moment, which, as I've said, I think is not doing us any favours in terms of reflecting the true nature of our fundamentals at this point and acknowledging a set of risks on the horizon that we need to keep an eye on and that we need to prepare ourselves for as best we can in fiscal terms, in terms of the interest rate set by the RBA. But I think we should, you know, also focus on the good things in our economy, and there are a lot of them.
So our fundamentals are pretty good. They may not be enough.
Well, as I said, I think Australians are inherently realistic in their assessment of what's happening in the world, even though I would probably agree that you could improve Australian news reporting. But as one of these shoppers in that Queensland shopping center said the other day, we are not stupid and people are really following what's happening. And even if they only have a limited access to news and international news, they can still sense what's going on. And I think the signs are clearly not that great at the moment.
All right, gentlemen, that is where we'll leave it. Thank you very much for joining me again.
Cheers, Richard.
Thank you.
Oliver Hartwich is Research Fellow at the Libertarian Think Tank, the Centre for Independent Studies. David Hetherington's the Executive Director of the Progressive Think Tank, Per Capital. I am interested to hear from you on this. Do get in touch either. You can jump on Facebook or you can go to our website, abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. And the phone number, of course, is 02833 1430. Just while we're on the whole big stories business, just before I tell you what we're doing next, if you're following the unfolding drama of the UK phone hacking scandal, you can hear special coverage online and on digital radio in the five capital cities tonight on ABC UK Newsgate. That's a digital radio channel from 8 p.m. Eastern time. There'll be background reports from then and then live coverage from 11:30 of the British Parliamentary Committee hearings where James and Rupert Murdoch will be questioned by MPs. That is tonight from 8 on digital radio, ABC UK Newsgate. That's what you look for. Still to come today on Life Matters, what men really think about love. But next, reviving Indigenous languages. What's at stake?